I want to continue in volume four, and it's January the 5th, 1901. And the subject is obedience. Louisa said, "As I was outside of myself, I saw the confessor placing the intention of the crucifixion. I was afraid to submit myself, but Jesus told me, 'What can I do? I cannot help obeying, because my humanity was made on purpose to obey.'" That's John 14:31, as well as all the other references in John where Jesus says, "I only do what my Father tells me to do. I only say what my Father tells me to say. The Father and I are one," and so on. So what you have here is Jesus acknowledging and responding to church authority. Now, what you find is that in exorcisms, Satan recognizes church authority as well and responds to it. This virtue of obedience, Jesus said, was so grafted within me that it can be said that obedience is nature in me. Now he's going to tell her, "I am obedience." Okay. It was nature in me, and the distinction dearest and most glorious to me. So much so that if my humanity did not have this of its own, I would abhor it, and I would never have united myself to it. Now, this is the exact opposite of all the pride that you find in the rest of us. "You then, you want to disobey," he said to Louisa. "You can do it, but you'll do it by yourself. I won't concur." And all confused in seeing God so obedient, Louisa said, "I too want to obey, and I submitted myself," she said, "and Jesus shared with me the pains of the cross." After this, Jesus transported me outside of myself, and blessed Jesus gave me a kiss. As he was doing this, a bitter breath came out of him, and he was in the act of wanting to pour his bitterness. But he didn't do it because he wanted to be told by me to do it. "Immediately," I said, "do you want some reparation? Let us do it together. In this way, my reparations united to yours will have the effects of your reparations. For if I do it on my own, I believe it would disgust you even more." So I took his hand, dripping with blood, and kissing it, I recited the Laudate Dominum, praise the Lord, prayer with the Gloria Patri. Jesus took one part and Louisa took the other to repair for the many evil works that are committed, placing the intention of praising Jesus as many times for as many offences as he receives because of evil works. How moving it was to see Jesus praying. And I want to give you Romans 8:26. "For those who love God, everything works out." And then I continue to do the same with the other hand, placing the intention of praising him for as many times and as many offences that he receives because of the sins of causes. And then his feet, with the intention of praising him as many times for as many evil steps and as many wrong paths which are covered, even under the appearance of piety and holiness. Lastly, his heart, with the intention of praising him for as many times as the human heart does not palpitate and does not love and does not desire God. My beloved Jesus seemed all refreshed by these reparations done together with him, but he was not yet content. Now notice that the reparations only have great value if our reparations are associated with Jesus' reparations, so we take on his infinite merits, and then we do them with the divine will so that they become divine reparations, and therefore they affect all souls, past, present and future. It seemed that Jesus wanted to pour, So Louisa said to him, "Lord, if you want to pour, I pray you to do it." So he poured his bitterness, and then he said, "My daughter, how much men offend me. But the time will come when I will chastise them in such a way that many little worms will come out, which will produce clouds of mosquitoes that will render them greatly oppressed." In other words, a plague of mosquitoes. It sounds like one of the plagues of the book of Revelation. And Louisa said, "And why will the the Pope will come out," he said. And Louisa said, "And why would the Pope come out?" And he said, "He will come out to console the people because oppressed, tired, crushed, betrayed by so many lies, they themselves will look for the harbour of truth. And all humiliated, they will ask the Holy Father to come into their midst to free them from so many evils and to place them in the harbour of safety." That's rather interesting. Now, we know that the Holy Father did come out to try and console people during the Second World War. So I want to give you Isaiah chapter 2, verses 6 to 20. In other words, the pride of man has to be brought low if everything on this earth is to be put back into God's order. Louisa said, "Lord, will this perhaps happen after the words you have spoken about the other times?" And he said, "Yes." In other words, he's not referring to anything in World War One or Two. And Louisa said, "I wish I could die before these things happen." He said, "And where would I go to stay then?" "Ah, Lord, there are so many good souls in which you can stay," she said, "such that in comparing myself to them, how bad I see myself." But not paying any attention to me, Jesus disappeared, because, I mean, the number of those souls that would love him at Louisa's level were just not there. So January the 6th, 1901, Jesus communicates himself to the three magi. So Louisa is meditating on the incidents after the birth of Jesus. "As I was outside of myself, I seemed to see the moment when the holy magi arrived at the grotto of Bethlehem. And as they arrived into the presence of the holy infant, Jesus was pleased to let the rays of his divinity shine externally, communicating himself to the magi in three ways: through love, through beauty, and through power. In such a way that they remained enraptured and engrossed in the presence of the little baby Jesus. So much so that if the Lord had not withdrawn the rays of his divinity internally again, they would have remained there forever, unable to move anymore. Then, as the baby withdrew his divinity, the holy magi returned into themselves. They stirred themselves, stupefied in seeing an excess of love so great, because through the light that the Lord had given to them, that is the enlightenment, he let them understand the mystery of the incarnation." So I want to give you Psalm 36, verse 9 there. "In your light, Lord, we see light." "Then they stood up and they offered their gifts to the Queen Mother, and she spoke at length with them, but I'm unable to say everything she said. I can only remember that she inculcated in them strongly not only their own salvation, but also taking to heart the salvation of their people, having no fear even to lay down their lives to obtain this intent." After this, Louisa said, "I withdrew inside of myself and I found myself together with Jesus. He wanted me to tell him something, but I saw myself so bad and confused that I wouldn't dare to tell him anything. Seeing that I was not saying anything, he himself continued to speak about the holy magi, telling me, 'By having communicated myself to the magi in three ways,'" now we're going to be talking about three effects that it has on them, "I obtained three effects for them, because I never communicate myself to souls uselessly. Rather, they always receive some profit for themselves. So as I communicated myself through love, they obtained detachment from themselves. As I showed myself through beauty, they obtained contempt for earthly things. And when I showed myself through power, their hearts remained all bound to me, and they obtained the bravery to lay down their blood and lives for me. And then he added, "And you, what do you want? Tell me, do you love me? How would you want to love me?" Not knowing what to say, as my confusion increased, I said, "Lord, I would want nothing but you. And if you say to me, do you love me, I have no words to be able to manifest it. I can only say that I feel this conviction that no one may be able to prevail over me in loving you." Now, a lot of the saints have said that. Nobody will love you more than I do. But in Louise's case, since she is brought into the divine level, then it's true, absolutely. "I feel this conviction that no one may be able to prevail over me in loving you, and that I should be the first in loving you above everyone, and no one may be able to surpass me. But this does not content me yet. In order to be content, I would want to love you with your own love." That means to love Jesus divinely, which you can only do in the divine will. "So that I may be able to love you as you love yourself. Ah, yes, only then would my concerns about loving you cease. Content, one would say, with my nonsense, Jesus clasped me tightly to himself, that I could see myself transmuted into him, inside and out. And he communicated part of his love to me, part because Louisa is a creature and can only take a small amount. And of course, he's infinite. And if I have a little jug and I fill the jug with water, you may have a gallon of water, but there's no room in this jug for a gallon of water. Once it's full, it's full. So because Jesus is infinite and she's finite, then the overflowing of his love can only go a certain distance. So after this, Louisa said, I returned into myself, and it seemed to me that for as much love as I'd given him, so much do I possess my good. And if I love him little, I possess him little. That's the very important thing, that loving and possession go together. So January the 9th, 1901, the subject here now is union. This morning I felt all oppressed and crushed, so much so that I went in search of relief. My only good made me wait a long time for his coming. And then, on coming, he told me, "My daughter, did I not take your passions, miseries, and weaknesses upon myself for love of you? Would you not want to take those of others upon yourself for love of me?" Now, there I want to give you Romans 13, 8 to 10, the debt of love that we owe the Lord for others. And then he added, "What I want is that you would be always united with me like a sun's ray which remains always fixed in the centre of the sun and which receives life from the sun as well as heat and splendour. Suppose that a ray would depart from the centre of the sun, what would become of it? Immediately after leaving, it would lose its life, light and heat and would return to darkness and would be reduced to nothing. Of course, that's what happened to Lucifer when he broke away from God, who is light, that he himself became one who lost life, light and love and returned to darkness and hatred and nothingness. Such is the soul, Jesus said. As long as she remains united with me in my center, it can be said that she is like the sun's ray, which lives, receives life from the sun, and goes wherever the sun wants. In sum, it remains at the complete disposal and at the will of the sun. If then she distracts herself and disunites herself from me, there she is, all darkness, cold, without feeling within herself that supernal spur of divine life. So with this, he disappeared. So here he's telling us that this spirituality of living in the divine will presumes union with God. And if we move away from union with God at all, even for a few minutes, then we're shifting into darkness and disintegration. We must stay there in the fire of God's infinite love in order for him to be able to do what he wants to do with us. So January the 15th, 1901, Jesus tells her that she forms his greatest martyrdom. I have a little heading for myself over this one, and it says, "Stop complaining." Since in the past days my beloved Jesus made himself seen as somehow indignant with the world, this morning, not seeing him come, I kept thinking to myself, who knows whether he's not coming because he wants to send some chastisement? And what have I done wrong? Now, she knows that his staying away has nothing to do with her doing wrong, but she persists in this opinion. Because he wants to send chastisements, he does not deign to come to me, which is correct. Okay, that should be a small M-E. My book has a capital M there. How nice that while he wants to punish others, he has me get the greatest of chastisements, which is the privation of him. Now, while I was saying this and other nonsense, my beloved Jesus made himself seen for just a little, and he said, "My daughter, you form the greatest martyrdom for me, because when I have to send some chastisement, I cannot show myself to you, since you bind me everywhere and you don't want me to do anything. And as I don't come, you deafen me with your complaints, with your laments and your expectations, so much so that while I'm occupied with chastising, I'm forced to think about you, to hear you, and my heart is lacerated in seeing you in your painful state of my privation. In fact, the most painful martyrdom is, in fact, the martyrdom of love, the martyrdom of the heart. And the more two persons love each other, the more painful these pains become, which arise not from others, but from between themselves. Therefore, be quiet, be calm, and do not want to increase my pains through your pains." So he begs her to stop complaining. Now, he fails completely in that, because as we go on in the volumes, she will continue as if she had never heard this. So probably this message lasts for as long as she writes it. "He disappeared, and I was left all mortified, thinking that I formed the martyrdom of my dear Jesus, and that in order not to make him suffer too much, when he does not come, I must remain quiet. But who can make this sacrifice?" she says. "Who can make this one? It seems impossible to me, and I will be forced to continue. I will be forced to continue martyring each other." So she says, "There's no way I can handle that." Because when he goes, she goes into a paroxysm of pain. And that's because of the extraordinary grace of union with God that she has. So January the 16th, 1901, I have a VIP on this one. And this is about love, and especially love for the souls in purgatory. "As I continue to see him a little indignant with the world, I wanted to occupy myself with placating him, but he distracted me by saying, the love most acceptable to me," the word in my book is charity, "the love most acceptable to me is towards those who are closest to me. And those who are closest to me are the purging souls." So this is love for the souls in purgatory, because they are confirmed in my grace. In other words, they are saved, and they are guaranteed that they will go to heaven. And there's no opposition between my will and theirs. They live continuously in me. They ardently love me, and I am forced to see them suffer within myself. And the reason for that is they have not finished their purification. And Hebrews 12:14 says that nothing unholy or unworthy can enter the presence of God. So I'm forced to see them suffer within myself, impotent to give themselves the slightest relief on their own. So once they go to purgatory, they can no longer help themselves. They are completely, literally helpless. Oh, how tortured my heart is by the position of these souls, because because they're not far away. They're close to me. And not only close, but they're actually inside of me because they're in the divine will. And how pleasing to my heart, one who interests himself with them. This is very important. Suppose you had a mother or a sister who lived with you in a state of sorrow, incapable of helping themselves on their own, and then someone else, foreign, who lived outside of your house, also in a state of sorrows, but capable of helping himself by himself. Would you not be more pleased if someone occupied himself with relieving your mother and your sister because they are your family, rather than the foreign one who can help himself on his own? And Louisa said, certainly, Lord. Okay. Now, the foreign one who can help himself are those of us on earth who can still go to the sacraments, we can pray, we can do penance, we can help ourselves. But the ones who are in need and can do nothing for themselves are the souls in purgatory. Now, so that's number one. That's love for the souls in purgatory. Now, number two, the next paragraph is love for those who love Jesus on earth. And then he added, the second love most acceptable to my heart is for those who, though living on this earth, are almost like purging souls. That is, they love me, they always do my will, they interest themselves with my things as if they were their own. Now, if these are oppressed or in need and in a state of sufferings, and someone occupies themselves with relieving them and helping them, this is more pleasing to me than it was done to other people. And again, it's because these souls are closer to him. So I want to give you John 17 there, where in his priestly prayer, Jesus prayed for his disciples. Now, the third love, and you know, in our tradition, we would have put this one first, but he puts it third, and that's helping to save sinners. Then Jesus disappeared, and as I found myself inside of myself, it seemed to me that those things did not go according to truth. You see, traditionally, we'd put it the other way around. So on coming back, my adorable Jesus made me understand that what he had told me was according to truth. There was only something left to say about the members separated from him, that is, those who are sinners, outside of grace, therefore. That if one occupied themselves with reuniting these members, this would be very acceptable to his heart. The difference that exists is this: that if a sinner were oppressed in the midst of a misfortune and one occupied himself not to convert him, but to relieve and help him materially, the Lord would be more pleased if this were done for those who are in the order of grace. In other words, Matthew 8:22, we're to let the dead bury the dead. But if someone is disposed and ready to come to grace, yes, it's a wonderful thing to help them. In fact, if these suffer, it's always a product either of the love of God for them or their love for God. And if sinners suffer, the Lord sees in them the mark of guilt and their obstinate will. Now, you know from all of these writings, and it'll become more and more clear as we go along, that the greatest pain for the Lord is the obstinate will of a human being. Because all our happiness, joy, peace, everything lies in living in the divine will. So this is how I seem to understand, Louisa said. After all, I leave the judgment to those who have the right to judge me, whether this is according to truth or not. So that's what she's saying. I leave it to the church. She can make her own decision. January the 24th, 1901, Louisa asks Jesus for the reason for his privation, and he explains it. Now, but you're going to have this conversation many times. Having spent the last days in silence, the past days in silence, and sometimes also without my adorable Jesus, this morning as he came, I lamented to him, saying, Lord, how is it that you do not come? How things have changed. It shows that it is either for the chastisement of my sins that you deprive me of your lovable presence, or because you no longer want me in this state of victim. She's always coming to these two wrong conclusions. And no matter how often he explains it, she will still persist in this opinion. Oh, please, I beg you, let me know your will. If I could not be oppressed when you wanted the sacrifice from me, much less can I do it now. Sorry. If I could not be oppressed when you wanted the sacrifice from me, much less can I do it now, that finding me no longer worthy of being a victim, you want to take me out of it. Now, Jesus doesn't want to take her out of it. This is her own imagination. Interrupting me, Jesus said, my daughter, by having made myself victim for mankind, taking upon myself all weaknesses, miseries, and everything that man deserved before the divinity, I represent the head of all. And since I'm the head before the divinity, the human race finds in me a most powerful shield that defends it, protects it, excuses it, and intercedes for it. That's Hebrews 7:25. The Lord ever lives to make intercession for us since his ascension. Now, since you are in a state of being a victim soul, you come to represent for me the head of the present generation. Head means a leader. Therefore, having to send some chastisement for the good of the people and to call them back to me, if I came to you as usual, by just showing myself to you, I'd already feel relieved because he's meeting someone who loves him. My pains are mitigated, and it happens to me as to someone who feels a strong pain and screams because of the spasm. If his pain ceased, he would no longer feel like screaming and sending out laments. The same happens with me. As my pains are mitigated, naturally I no longer feel like sending out chastisements. You then also naturally, in seeing me, try to spare me and to take the pains of others upon yourself. Now, naturally means that it's your normal response to me. It's your response of love. You cannot help doing your office of a victim soul before my presence. And if you didn't do it, which can never be, I would be displeased with you. This is the cause of my privation. It's not because I want to punish your sins. I have other ways to purge you. However, I will repay you. On the days to come, I will double my visits. Aren't you happy? And she said, no, Lord, I want you always, whatever the cause may be. I do not give way to remaining a single day without you. And while I was saying this, he disappeared and Louisa came back to herself. So she's not ready to negotiate any absences at all. So January the 27th, 1901, the establishment of faith is the establishment of charity or divine love. As I was in my usual state, my adorable Jesus made himself seen for a little while, and I don't know why. He said to me, my daughter, the whole establishment of the Catholic faith is in the establishment of charity or love, agape, love, divine love. Now, let me read that again. The whole establishment of the Catholic faith is the establishment of love, which unites the hearts and makes them live in me. Then, throwing himself into my arms, he wanted me to refresh him. And after I did as much as I could, he gave me tit for tat and he disappeared. So I want to give you some things about love, which I've given to you many times before. John 13:34. John 15:9, Ephesians 3:16-21. And there are others as well, of course. So January 30th, 1901, Jesus talks about the poison of self-interest. This morning on coming, blessed Jesus transported me outside of myself in the midst of many people of different conditions. There were priests, nuns, there were secular people, that is, people out in the world. The beginning of his sorrow and beginning his sorrowful lament, he said, "My daughter, the poison of self-interest has entered into all hearts." Okay. Now, this self-interest is to get something for me out of what I do. This modern thing, what's in it for me? That's the thing he's saying is absolutely deadly. "My daughter, the poison of self-interest has entered into all hearts, and they have become soaked with this poison like sponges. This pestilent poison has penetrated into monasteries, into priests, and into everybody outside in society. My daughter, that which does not surrender to the light of truth and to the power of virtue surrenders before a most wretched self-interest." Now, what he's saying here is that if our hidden motivations are really for ourselves and to benefit ourselves, like you'll hear people saying, "Well, I just want to save my own soul. I'm not interested in anybody else." Or they're doing something which appears to be very good and praiseworthy, but they're actually doing it for the wrong reasons. Jesus says that absolutely destroys it, and he calls it a pestilent poison. "Before this poison," he said, "the most sublime and excelling virtues fall shattered like fragile glass." Isn't that sad? And while saying this, he cried bitterly. In other words, we are our own worst enemies. We don't need anybody else. There's a statement in Psalm 62, I think it is, that "I'm like a tottering wall and a tumbling fence." And that actually describes us very, very well. We're able to destroy ourselves with no help from anybody else. "Who can say the torment of my soul in seeing my most loving Jesus cry? Not knowing what to do to make him stop crying, I spoke some nonsense. My dear, please do not cry. If the others do not love you, offend you, and have their eyes dazzled by the poison of self-interest, in such a way as to remain all soaked with it, there is still me, and I love you, I praise you, and I look at all that is earthly as rubbish, and I aspire to nothing but to have you. Therefore, you should be content in my love and stop crying. And if you feel embittered, pour it on me, for I am more content with it than seeing you cry." So, on hearing me, Jesus stopped crying and poured a little bit of his bitterness. And then he shared with me the pains of the cross, and he said, "My virtues and the merits I acquired for man in my passion are as many towers of fortitude on which everyone can lean along the journey, along the way to eternity." Now, we have two major towers of fortitude, and they are Jesus's own virtues and his merits to help us along the way. We're not alone. But man is ungrateful. Now, throughout the 36 volumes, the human being is described all the time as ungrateful, ungrateful, ungrateful. And we know that ourselves, that human beings are not grateful for what you do for them. But man, ungrateful, running away from these towers of fortitude, leans on mud and conducts himself along the way of perdition. So I want to give you Matthew 7, verses 13 to 14, the narrow way and the broad way. The broad way leads to hell and the narrow way to life. And then Jesus disappeared. So I also want to give you Proverbs 3, 5. "My son, lean not on your own understanding." So January the 31st, 1901, Jesus talks about patience. And before I begin, I want to give you some references. Romans 5, verses 3 to 4. Hebrews 10, 36 and 12, 1. And Revelation 14, 12. There's lots more as well, but that's get you going. As I was in my usual state, my sweet Jesus was not coming. Then after much waiting, I saw him for just a little. And he told me, my daughter, patience is superior to purity. Because without patience, the soul easily unbridles and it is difficult for her to remain pure. Now, what he's saying, the meaning of patience is long suffering. And we all have to be tested in this particular area, because if we're not willing to endure anything, then all the virtues will fall apart. And he says purity will fall apart as well. And we know that as well, that young people just have not got the patience to wait even 5 minutes. They want what they want now. Or as we say, they wanted yesterday. And so without patience, purity doesn't actually stand a chance. So let me read that again for you. My daughter, patience is superior to purity because without patience, the soul easily unbridles. And this is what we're seeing all around us in society today, is unbridled lust. And it is difficult for her to remain pure. And when a virtue needs another virtue in order to have life, the second one is called superior to the first. So purity needs patience. Even more, it can be said that patience is the custody of purity. Not only this, but it is the staircase to ascend to the mountain of fortitude. Now, for staircase, I want to give you John 1, 51, that where Jesus says he's the fulfillment of Genesis 28, where Jacob saw a ladder connecting heaven and earth and angels going up and down. So patience is the staircase to ascend to the mountain of fortitude in such a way that if one went up without the staircase of patience, he would immediately fall from the highest point to the lowest. And as you know, the most painful fall is the one from a great height. In addition to this, patience is the seed of perseverance. And this seed produces branches called firmness. Now, I want to give you Psalm 73, verse 4, and Hebrews 3, 6. Now, this firmness is stability, is the word we would use. Oh, how firm and stable. You see the two words are together now. Oh, how firm and stable in the good she has started is the patient soul. Sorry, it's very bad English. The patient soul has started a very good journey to become firm and stable. She pays no attention either to rain or to frost, ice or fire, but all her attention is on bringing to completion the good that she has started. In fact, there's no greater foolishness than that of one who today does some good because she likes it, and tomorrow neglects it because they feel no more pleasure in it. Matthew 7:25, by their fruits you will know them. What would one say if an eye, which at one hour possessed light and another hour was blind, or of a tongue which now speaks and then is mute? Ah yes, my daughter, patience alone is the secret key. Now, as we go to through these writings, the Lord will give us different keys that are absolutely essential for our spiritual growth. And this is one of them. Patience is the secret key to open the treasure of virtues. Without the secret of this key, the other virtues do not come out to give life to the soul and to ennoble her. That's very important because we don't hear a lot about patience in these writings. So that's a very good lesson there. So February the 5th, 1901, Louisa encounters two maidens who serve justice. This morning, Blessed Jesus transported me outside of myself, but he made himself seen in a state that moved even the stones to pity. Oh, how he suffered. It seemed that, unable to endure any more, he wanted to unload himself a little, almost asking for help. I felt my poor heart split with tenderness, and immediately I pulled the crown of thorns from him, putting it on myself so as to give him relief. And then I said to him, "My sweet good, you've not renewed in me the pains of the cross for some time. I pray you to renew them in me today, so that you will be more relieved." And he said, "My beloved, it is necessary to ask justice in order to do this." Now he tries to teach her the difference between justice and love. And of course, all of God's divine attributes are equal. They're infinitely equal. Because things have reached such a point that justice can no longer permit you to suffer. Okay. In other words, if things are so terrible that Louisa would have to make a difference, the sufferings she would have to endure might actually kill her. That's why you'd have to ask justice. Love pushes her to say, "Yes, I'll do it." But Jesus says justice has to temper love. And in the next paragraph, he gives us an insight into what's really wrong in the world. "I didn't know what to do in order to ask justice," Louisa said, "when two maidens came up to me who seemed to be serving justice. One had the name of Tolerance and the other of Dissimulation." That's very interesting, because dissimulation, that points to deception, which is widespread in society. And other words for dissimulation is disinformation or fake news. Okay, so it means that society tolerates all kinds of evil. So these two maidens had the name of Tolerance and Dissimulation. "And as I asked them to crucify me, Tolerance took one of my hands and nailed it, but without wanting to finish. And so I said, 'O holy Dissimulation, complete my crucifixion. Don't you see that Tolerance has left me? Show yourself how much better you are in dissimulating.' So she completed my crucifixion, but with such spasm that if the Lord had not sustained me in his arms, I would certainly have died." In other words, the Tolerance and the Dissimulation represent the whole of the 20th century. It was the century of deception. In the 20th century, we learned how to fake everything. It's perfectly normal for us. We don't even give a second thought to the fact that you could be wearing a string around your neck that looks like pearls, but you only bought them for a few pence. They're not real. And we have faked all kinds of beauty in art, in everything. Everything in society. And we even have fake virtues, you know, that people put on a show pretending that, you know, you're welcome or whatever. The example I would give you is someone going to a reception, and the people receiving you say, "Oh, you're very welcome." And behind your back say, "What on earth is she doing here?" You know, so there's also the fact that this Tolerance thing has become a disease in our society. We're so tolerant, we accept all sinfulness. We accept all that is totally against Christianity. We accept evil in the name of tolerance. It's really unbelievable. So Louisa really had to suffer. After this, Blessed Jesus said, "Daughter, it's necessary that you suffer these pains at least sometimes. And if it were not so, woe to the world. What would become of it?" And then she prayed to him for various people. Now, February the 6th, 1901. The perfect satisfaction of Jesus is finding himself in the soul. So what the Lord wants more than anything else is union of love with us. As I was in my usual state, Blessed Jesus on coming told me, "My daughter, when my grace is in possession of more people, it celebrates more." In other words, when grace has the critical mass of people, then the kingdom of God triumphs. But when sin has the critical mass, then chastisement has got to take over and try and bring some kind of recovery into the system. It happens as to queens. The more maidens that hang upon their wishes and surround them like a crown, the more they enjoy and make feast. You should fix yourself in me. You should look at me, and you will be so taken by me that everything material will drop dead for you. I want to give you Deuteronomy 6, 4 to 10. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul, all your mind and all your being. You must fix yourself in me so much as to draw me completely into yourself. And in such a way that finding myself in you, I may find in you my perfect satisfaction. So as I find in you all possible pleasures I could find in a human creature, what the others do to me cannot grieve me so much. So what the Lord needs is more and more and more people who really genuinely love him and who genuinely live for him and want him alone. And the more of us who do that, the more he has a place to live on earth, and that he can look with more compassion on the others because of us. And while saying this, he closed himself up inside of me and was all pleased. How fortunate I would consider myself if I arrived at drawing my beloved Jesus completely into myself. She already has him. She just doesn't acknowledge it. So February the 10th, 1901, we're back to obedience again. As my adorable Jesus continued to come, he made himself seen with eyes refulgent with most vivid and pure light. So that's 1 John 1, 5, God is light. I was enchanted and surprised before this dazzling light. Now, as you go on in these volumes, that dazzling light, you will be told, quite simply, is the divine will. And Jesus, on seeing me so enchanted and speechless, said to me, "My beloved, obedience has extremely long sight and surpasses the very light of the sun in beauty and in sharpness. In the same way, love of self, which we were talking about a few moments ago, is very short-sighted. So much so that it cannot take a step without tripping. And do not believe that this extremely long sight is possessed by those souls who go on always disturbed." Now, we've been told since volume one that we must not allow any interior disturbance in us, because that disturbance allows the demon to attack and keeps the Lord out, because Jesus only works in complete calm, because he is the King of Peace. So I'll repeat this again. Do not believe that this extremely long sight is possessed by those souls who go on always disturbed and in scrupulousness. Now, scrupulousness was a problem in the early church, in the early part of the 20th century. People thought there was some kind of holiness in being scrupulous. And in these writings, Jesus makes it perfectly clear that that scrupulousness is giving super attention to yourself. And it's nothing to do with love and all the rest of it. St. Thérèse of Lisieux had to battle with that and to overcome it until she came through to being completely love. So rather, this is a net that love of self weaves around them. Now, there is your explanation of scrupulousness. Okay, It's a net of love of self. The person is completely wound up with themselves, thinking about themselves all the time, which, being very short-sighted, make them fall first, and then provokes in them a thousand disturbances and scruples, because they keep on analysing it. Did I give in? Didn't I give in? Was it a mortal sin? Was it a venial sin? Was it this, that and the other? And what they have detested today, with so many scruples and fears, they fall into again tomorrow. And the reason is that they're not allowing love to dominate. They're not allowing love to take over. Love would push all of that aside and get on with loving God and loving the neighbour. So they fall again into it tomorrow, to the point that their living is reduced to being always immersed in this artificious net. Artificious is cleverly contrived net. In other words, it's a very clever way of Satan to keep us all locked up in ourselves and not even looking up enough to find out if God is there or my neighbour is there. So to the point that their living is reduced to being always immersed in this artificious or very cleverly contrived net, which love of self knows well how to weave around them. And the devil, of course, is thrilled. This unlike the extremely long sight of obedience, which is the killer of the love of self. That is why we're being shown all the time that Louisa is being exercised to the excess in obedience, because the Lord is trying to show us that the divine will cannot reign in us if the human will is reigning. And if the love of self is reigning, then the love of God cannot reign in us. So this is very clear. And if you put this with the teachings in volumes 1 and 2 about self-denial and mortification and all the rest of it, you see very clearly how to get free. So the extremely long sight of obedience is the killer of the love of self. Her sight is so very long and clear, she can see things clearly, whereas with scrupulousness, you don't see. It's like being in a fog. That immediately she foresees where she might slip, and with generous heart, she abstains from it. There's your self-denial and mortification. And enjoys the holy freedom of the children of God, which Paul describes wonderfully in Romans chapter 8. And just as darkness draws more darkness, so does light draw more light. And this light arrives at drawing to itself the light of the word, and uniting together, they weave the light of all the virtues. It's a wonderful thing. So the more we move towards love, we're moving towards light. And the more love and light take over, the more God is able to operate within us. Surprised on hearing this, because scrupulosity was considered somehow a holy thing in the early 20th century, Louisa said, "Lord, what are you saying? To me, it seems that the scrupulous way of living is sanctity." And he, with a more serious tone, he said, "On the contrary, I tell you, this is the true mark of obedience, while that is the true mark of love of self. And that way of living moves me more to indignation than to love." And the reason is that the people with this scrupulousness and all this wrapped up in themselves are the priests and the nuns and the brothers who are supposed to be loving God and loving their neighbours and keeping the church alive and well. And Satan is wrapping them all up in these terrible nets of self-love. In fact, when it is the light of truth that allows one to see one's faults, be it even in the slightest way, there should be some emendation, the book says. There should be some improvement. But since it is the short sight of the love of self, it does nothing but keep them oppressed, having no development on the path of true sanctity. So there's Jesus trying to correct something that's really wrong in the way people are living the spiritual life in 1901. February the 17th, 1901. This is about our origin, where we came from. This morning, as I was all oppressed and in suffering, Louisa said, I saw my beloved Jesus for just a little. As well as many people immersed in many miseries. Then, breaking the silence he had kept for many days, he said, My daughter, man is born in me first, that is, in eternity. Receiving the imprint of the divinity, that's Genesis 1:27 and Genesis 2:7, that's the image of God, that's the imprint of the divinity. Then, as he goes out of me to be reborn in the maternal womb in time, that is, so the first one is in eternity, I give him the command to walk a little stretch of the way. And at the end of that way, letting myself be found by him, I receive him again back into myself, making him live eternally with me. So this is the circle of our lives. See now how noble man is, where he comes from and where he goes, and what his destiny is. Now, should the sanctity of this man, what should the sanctity of this man be coming out of a God who is so holy? But in covering the way to come to me again, man destroys that of the divine which he has received. He destroys much of the divine that he has received, and that's with our sins. He corrupts himself in such a way that at the encounter I have with him to receive him into myself, I no longer recognize him. I no longer see the divine imprint in him. I find nothing of my own in him. So the love, joy, peace, patience, kindness and goodness of Galatians 5:20 is missing, the fruits of the Spirit. And no longer recognizing him, my justice condemns him as a lost soul to go wandering the way of perdition. That's sad. Now, the description of man here corrupting himself is the description of the prodigal son in Luke 15. Because Jesus tells us that the whole human race is actually the prodigal son, created by God, destroyed by man. How tender it was to hear Jesus speak about this, how many things he made me understand, but my state of suffering doesn't permit me to write any more. March the 8th, 1901, we're talking about the cross. Continuing in my poor state and with the silence of Blessed Jesus this morning, as I was oppressed more than ever, on coming, he said to me, My daughter, it was not my works, nor my preaching, nor the very power of my miracles that made me recognized with clarity as the God I am, but it was when I was put on the cross and lifted up on it as though on my own throne. Then I was recognized. Okay. He said that already in John chapter 3, I can't remember the verse. When I am lifted up from the earth, I will draw all men to myself. John 8:28 and John 12:32 to 34. So it was when you go through the hours of the agony of Jesus on the cross in the hours of the Passion, you'll see clearly what he's referring to here is that everybody was completely astonished, having tortured Jesus beyond recognition, that his responses were completely divine, to the point where his executioner said, that man was a son of God. He was something else and became one of his disciples, Longinus. So the cross alone revealed me to the world and to the whole of hell for who I really was. Now, hell would recognize him the moment he forgave everybody. Father, forgive them. They don't realize what they're doing. Only heaven can do that. Hell was completely lost at that particular point. All were shaken, and recognize their creator, okay? Because their creator that they were looking at on the cross is in 1 John 4, 7 to 17, that God is perfect love. And what they were looking at on the cross was perfect love. Therefore, it is the cross that reveals God to the soul and makes known whether the soul is truly of God or not. It can be said that the cross uncovers all the intimate parts of the soul and reveals to God and to men who she is. Wow. It's only as we go through the terrible crosses in life that who we really are is actually revealed as well. It's absolutely amazing. And then he added, upon two crosses, I consume souls. One of these crosses is pain and the other is love. Now, Saint Thérèse of Lisieux actually consecrated herself to be a victim of divine love. And she experienced in a very real way, but on a spiritual level, the passion of Jesus in her dying. And just as in heaven, all nine choirs of angels love me, though each one has its distinct office. As, for example, the special office of the seraphim is love, and their choir is positioned more in the front, naturally enough, because God is love, in order to receive the reverberations of my love, so much so that my love and theirs darting through each other correspond continuously. In the same way, I give to souls on earth their distinct offices. Some I render martyrs of pain, others I render martyrs of love. As both of them are skillful masters in sacrificing souls and in rendering them worthy of my satisfactions. So what is reflected in heaven in the choirs of angels is reflected on earth in the different types of martyrdom that the Lord calls people into. Now I'm going to leave it there just for the moment.